Good morning, brothers and sisters. Bless you. Just wanted to comment. Ivan, you said that doing a Bible study is not maybe your favorite thing, but I was very, very blessed by the Bible study. Also, I could see that it wasn't just something you kind of did. You put a lot of thought and effort into presenting it. I appreciate that. I was blessed by it. For the morning's message, turn in your Bibles to Habakkuk. We will also get the book up on the screen. Let's put it. And we're going to read the entire book. It is only 3 chapters long. I don't know how many of you are familiar with Habakkuk. And if you are familiar with Habakkuk, I don't know what goes through your mind when his name gets mentioned. Perhaps you think immediately of a way that God has spoken to you through Habakkuk. I know that's true for me. Before I... There was a time many years ago where I got up one morning and my Bible was on the table, and I opened it to Habakkuk. I wasn't necessarily planning to turn to Habakkuk. I just opened my Bible, and it opened to Habakkuk 3, and I was reading NIV, and it's Habakkuk 3, beginning at verse 2. It says, "Lord, I have heard of your fame. I stand in awe of your deeds, Lord. Repeat them in our day. In our time, make them known. In wrath, remember mercy." And it really spoke to me that morning, simply where I was, in the way I was thinking. I was so much desiring to see God work and repeat them. And I felt like I heard and I read of God doing things in the past, but I wanted him to repeat them in our day and in our time to make them known. And you cannot mention the book of Habakkuk without me immediately going back to that morning where I read those verses. Now, I didn't study the context of Habakkuk or anything that morning. It was just a word that I have never forgotten. So I don't know. Perhaps that is also true. There's another thing that I think of. When I think of Habakkuk, I think immediately of the dilemma that Habakkuk faced as revealed in the discourse in what we're going to read. The struggle he had with what he was seeing. You just think that, you know, when you're naming your children, you look for names in the Bible, and Habakkuk might not be the first one you think of in naming your children. I don't know what you think, but it doesn't really matter. There's certain circumstances that bring out certain emotions, and it is that draws me to the book of Habakkuk these days. The circumstances that drive me to the book are always unpleasant and painful. And if you know the book at all, I'm sure you are not surprised to hear that it is when I am forced to look upon circumstances in life that seem cruel and unjust and entirely contrary to everything I want to believe about a good God being in total control of the universe, and being in total control over the actions of man. And it is when I'm struggling with things like this that I think of the prophet Habakkuk, because I realize that I am not alone in trying to reconcile these things that I see. I'm not alone in trying to understand how a good God can allow bad things. In fact, hundreds, probably thousands, or more than 1,000 years ago, there was a man named Habakkuk. who struggled with the same things. Let's read it. Habakkuk, beginning at the very start. The oracle that Habakkuk the prophet saw. O Lord, how long shall I cry for help, and you will not hear? Or cry to you, violence, and you will not save? Why do you make me see iniquity, and why do you look idly at wrong? Destruction and violence are before me. Strife and contention arrives. So the law is paralyzed, and justice never goes forth. For the wicked surround the righteous, and justice is perverted. The Lord's answer. Look among the nations. And we're reading the whole book. I'm going to draw certain things out of it. There's a lot of descriptive things in here that I'm not necessarily going to spend much time on, but I'd like to read the whole thing. The Lord's answer. Look among the nations and see. Wonder and be astounded. For I am doing a work in your days that you would not believe if told. For behold, I am raising up the Chaldeans, that bitter and hasty nation, who march through the breadth of the earth to seize dwellings not their own. They are dreaded and fearsome. Their justice and dignity go forth for themselves. Another thing, actually, I was going to mention before we read here. You will notice the difference in Habakkuk's tone from when he starts saying, how long shall I cry for help and you will not hear, or cry to you violence and you will not save. He breaks in that way, and then notice what he says at the end. Just pay attention to it and try, like, something within this book brought Habakkuk from a place of questioning and coming before God in an honest, broken way, but questioning God. And something in what God told Habakkuk in this little discourse brought him to a place where he expressed complete confidence and trust. And you may see some things that God told Habakkuk that may have brought him to the place that I don't. But you will notice that. At the beginning, he's questioning I'm not going to say bitterly, but kind of in that tone. And at the end, he expresses entire trust regardless. In the beginning, he's questioning God because of circumstances. And at the end of the book, he is expressing entire and complete trust in God despite circumstances. And something in that discourse brought about that change. Look among the nations and see, wonder and be astounded, for I am doing a work in your days that you would not believe if told. For behold, I am raising up the Chaldeans, that bitter and hasty nation who march through the breadth of the earth to seize dwellings not their own. They are dreaded and fearsome. Their justice and dignity go forth from themselves. Their horses are swifter than leopards, more fierce than the evening wolves. Their horsemen press proudly on. Their horsemen come from afar. They fly like an eagle, swift to devour. They all come for violence. All their faces are forward. They gather captives like sand. At kings they scoff, and at rulers they laugh. They laugh at every fortress, for they pile up earth and take it. Then they sweep by like the wind and go on. Guilty men, whose own might is their God. Habakkuk's second complaint. Are you not from everlasting, O Lord my God, my Holy One? We shall not die. O Lord, you have ordained them as a judgment, and you, O rock, have established them for reproof. You who are of purer eyes than to see evil and cannot look at wrong. Why do you look idly at traitors and remain silent when the wicked swallows up the man more righteous than himself? You make mankind like the fish of the sea, like crawling things that have no ruler. He brings them all up with a hook, and he drags them out with his net. He gathers them in his dragnet, so he rejoices and is glad. Therefore he sacrifices to his net and makes offerings to his dragnet. For by them he lives in luxury, and his food is rich. Is he then to keep on emptying his net and mercilessly killing the nations forever? I will take my stand at my watchpost and station myself on the tower, and look out to see what he will say to me, and what I will answer concerning my complaint. The righteous shall live by his faith. And the Lord answered me, write the vision, make it plain on tablets, so he may run who reads it. For still the vision awaits its appointed time. It hastens to the end. It will not lie. If it seems slow, wait for it. It will surely come. It will not delay. Behold, his soul is puffed up. It is not upright within him. But the righteous shall live by his faith. Moreover, wine is a traitor and an arrogant man who is never at rest. His greed is as wide as Sheol. Like death, he never has enough. He gathers for himself all nations, and he collects as his own all peoples. Shall not all these take up their taunt against him with scoffing and riddles for him and say, woe to him who heaps up what is not his own, for how long? And loads himself with pledges? Will not your debtors suddenly arise and those awake who will make you tremble? Then you will be spoiled for them, because you have plundered many nations. All the remnant of the peoples shall plunder you, for the blood of man and violence to the earth, to the cities and all who dwell in them. Woe to him who gets evil gain for his house. So, to set his nest on high, to be safe from the reach of harm, you have devised shame for your house. By cutting off many peoples, you have forfeited your life. For the stone will cry out from the wall, and the beam from the woodwork respond. Woe to him who builds a town with blood and founds a city on iniquity. Behold, is it not from the Lord of hosts that people labor merely for fire and nations weary themselves for nothing? For the earth will be filled with the knowledge of the glory of the Lord as waters cover the sea. Woe to him who makes his neighbors drink. You pour out your wrath and make them drunk in order to gaze at their nakedness. You will have your fill of shame instead of glory. Drink yourself and show your uncircumcision. The cup in the Lord's right hand will come around to you, and utter shame will come upon your glory. The violence done to Lebanon will overwhelm you, as will the destruction of the beasts that terrified them, for the blood of man and violence to the earth, to cities and all who dwell in them. Of what profit is an idol, when its maker has shaped it, a metal image, a teacher of lies? For its maker trusts in his own creation, when he makes speechless idols. Woe to him who says to a wooden thing, awake, to a silent stone, arise. Can this teach? Behold, it is overlaid with gold and silver, and there is no breath at all in it. But the Lord is in his holy temple. Let all the earth keep silence before him. Habakkuk's prayer, a prayer of Habakkuk the prophet according to Shigionath. O Lord, I have heard the report of you, and your work, O Lord, do I fear. In the midst of the years, revive it. In the midst of the years, make it known. In wrath, remember mercy. God came from Teman, and the Holy One from Mount Paran. His splendor covered the heavens, and the earth was full of his praise. Selah. His brightness was like the light. Rays flashed from his hand, and there he veiled his power. Before him went pestilence. Plague followed at his heels. He stood and measured the earth, and he looked and shook the nations. Then the eternal mountains were scattered, and the everlasting hills sank low. His were the everlasting ways. I saw the tents of Cushan in affliction, and the curtains of the land of Midian did tremble. Was your wrath against the rivers, O Lord? Was your anger against the rivers, or your indignation against the sea? When you rode on your horses, on your chariot of salvation, you stripped the sheath from your bow, calling for many arrows. You split the earth with rivers. The mountains saw you, and they writhed. The raging waters swept on. The deep gave forth its voice. It lifted its hands on high. The sun and the moon stood still in their place at the light of your arrows as they sped, at the flash of your glittering spear. You marched through the earth in fury. You threshed the nations in anger. You went out for the salvation of your people, for the salvation of your anointed. You crushed the head of the house of the wicked, laying him bare from thigh to neck. You pierced with his own arrows the heads of his warriors, who came like a whirlwind to scatter me, rejoicing as if to devour the poor in secret. You trampled the sea with your horses, the surging of mighty waters. I hear, and my body trembles. My lips quiver at the sound. Rottenness enters into my bones. My legs tremble beneath me. Yet I will quietly wait for the day of trouble to come upon the people who invade us. Though the fig tree should not blossom, nor fruit beyond the vines, the produce of the olive fail, and the fields yield no food. Though the flock be cut off from the fold, and there be no herd in the stalls, yet will I rejoice in the Lord. I will take joy in the God of my salvation. God, the Lord, is my strength. He makes my feet like the feet of a deer. He makes me to tread on high places. And it looks like this was actually a song to the choir master. To the choir master with stringed instruments. So if we look at the last couple verses and the first couple verses, we see immediately that somehow Habakkuk's perspective changed. from a place of questioning because of the circumstances. He went to a place of trust despite the circumstances. I'd like to look specifically at the word violence in chapter 1, verse 2 and 3. O Lord, how long shall I cry for help and you will not hear, or cry to you violence and you will not save? Why do you make me see iniquity? Why do you look idly at wrong? Destruction and violence are before me. Strife and contention arise. So the law is paralyzed, and justice never goes forth. For the wicked surround the righteous, and justice is perverted. If you want, you can contribute here. What comes to mind? I say violence. What do you think? Can I have someone run a portable mic? I think there was two hands, Wayne Martin, and I thought there was one over here. Push it up again. Wayne Martin.
This.
Injustice. Okay. Any specific incidences? I say the word violence. Is there any specific incidents that jumps into your mind right away? Maybe something you saw or something you heard, something you read about that happened years ago. Anything like that? You see, when we read the first four verses, we see a man, and I've been there. I've been before God, and I've said, "Violence, Lord, how long are you going to put up with this? Why do you make me look at this? You are too righteous for this. How can a good God just seem to let these things perpetually keep going?" And that's I think where Habakkuk is in context. He is disturbed that wicked nations that are more wicked than his own nation seem to have the upper hand. But he is seeing violence, and he has a real problem with it. We can take certain responses to this. We could respond and some people have. If I could find the quote here. I'm not very organized. There's a man by the name of Alan Hume, I think. He's a Scotsman, and he's a philosopher and debates a lot. And he says something to this effect. We're a stranger. Suddenly to drop into this world, I would show him as a specimen of its ills, a hospital full of diseases, a prison full of malefactors and debtors, a battlefield strewn with carcasses, a fleet floundering in the ocean, a nation languishing under tyranny and famine and pestilence. Honestly, I cannot see how you can possibly square what we see with an ultimate purpose of love. And another man has said, it is not science that has led me to doubt the purpose of God. It is the state of this world. It is this pitiless, unending struggle for the existence among the nations. You see, we see things like Habakkuk was seeing, and whatever might come to your mind of injustice, things that are not right, things that are a violation, and we can start thinking like that. And some people have rejected God because of it. And you think that through, and I'm going to try to make a slightly intellectual argument at the start here. Violence implies something, does it not? Violence means to violate. which implies that there is something to violate. If there is nothing to violate, there is no violence. So if you are upset with the violations you see and the violence you see and the wrong that you see, that means that you have settled it in your heart that there is something right. And what you're seeing goes against what is right. And if you think that through, it then makes no sense to reject God based on the violence that you see. Because if an ultimate purpose of love and an ultimate purpose of things that are sacred and good and right exist, and morality exists, then a moral lawgiver exists. And a perpetuator of this good exists. If he doesn't exist, violence doesn't exist. If he doesn't exist, you have nothing to violate. I don't know if I'm making sense to you. You look kind of blank. But that's how I think when I see things like this. And even in reconciling these things in my own head, I see things and I'm upset with them because it's wrong and it's violent. It's violence. And I realize that, you know, turning away from God based on that is foolish, because then violence ceases to exist. Getting back to thinking about violence, and trust me, I do not intend to leave off on a black, hopeless, what is this world coming to kind of a note. I don't intend to leave off there, so bear with me. But there's certain pictures that come to my mind when I think of violence and certain circumstances. Adolf Hitler. I cannot think of violence without thinking of Adolf Hitler almost immediately. And to this day, you can go to death camps in Auschwitz, and I'm not even going to. I have a friend that I know who he's a Mennonite who doesn't have a driver's license, but he enjoys traveling. And I think he went over to Europe with a boat and then biked all over Europe, somewhat adventuresome. I'm impressed by that, actually. But he went to the death camp of Auschwitz, and I talked to him about it briefly. And you go to Auschwitz, and you see pictures drawn on the walls of different scientific experiments. There was a doctor, a Nazi doctor by the name of Joseph Mengele, who experimented on young children in the death camp of Auschwitz, and he did terrible things to humanity. Crass, brutal things. There's a room in Auschwitz that has 14,000 pounds of women's hair. After they took them to the gas chambers, they took their hair to sell it on the marketplace for wigs and stuff like that. And you cannot think of the atrocities that Hitler committed without something inside of you screaming violence. This is vile violence. A picture that comes to my mind when I think of violence, and I don't think I will ever forget it, I still remember exactly where I was on September 11, 2001, when I heard that Chet had flown into one of the towers in New York. I was on the farm where we are now. Karen and I hadn't married yet, but I was living there with the couple who owned it before we did, and she came out and told me, and it didn't take very long until I had found a seat in front of the TV in the house, and I watched that second Chet fly into the tower, and there's pictures there that I don't think I will ever lose, and in my heart I was screaming, violence, Lord. Violence. You know, you saw, I remember one woman especially, she was running straight towards the camera and her mouth was wide open and she was screaming. And you saw people behind you, you saw people jumping out of the World Trade Centers and you knew they were dying. And somewhere inside of you, you're screaming, violence, Lord. Why don't you do something about these things? It's just, and I'm sure that you yourselves, if you stop and think about it, there are incidences that come to your mind where in your heart, if you knew it or not, you were screaming, "Violence, Lord, how long will you look at iniquity? How long will you look at these wrong things?" And sit there with your hands folded. It's what it seems like to us. It could be, I don't know, a death in a family or suicides, someone killed, someone committed suicide that you loved or anything like that. I don't know what your life consists of. I don't know the pain that you've seen. And you look to God and you wonder, how long is this going to last? The law is paralyzed and justice never goes forth. The wicked surround the righteous and justice is perverted. Another thing that always comes to my mind when I think of violence. There's one thing about committing wrongs against each other as adults, and it's an entirely different thing, and it brings out an entirely different emotion in me when it's adults committing wrongs against children. Same thing. You come before God, and you scream, "Violence, Lord. Why is the law paralyzed? How long must we look at these things?" And you do nothing. Why do you look idly on wrong? Why don't you do something? We might be tempted to embrace the notion that God is not who he says he is. David Hume, in his argument that there is no God, says that, I think I've read this, but I'll read it again. "Were a stranger suddenly to drop into this world, I would show him, as a specimen of its ills, a hospital full of diseases, a prison full of malefactors and debtors, a battlefield strewn with carcasses, a fleet floundering in the ocean, and a nation languishing under tyranny, famine, and pestilence. Honestly, I cannot see how you can possibly square all of that with an ultimate purpose of love." Another man says, "It is not science that has led me to doubt the purpose of God. It is the state of this world. It is this pitiless, unending struggle for survival. That settles it for me." The idea that violence, a violation of that which is right, should drive us away from God is, I've tried to explain why I think intellectually that does not work. Because at that point in time, there is no right or wrong. And if you feel like, or if an evil man feels like doing something and he does it, and there is no moral lawgiver, you've rejected the idea of God, he is within his rights to do that. I mean, there is no right and wrong. Maybe time for a little bit of humor. I heard of a debate, and I forget the guy's names. I wish I remembered them, but I don't. But it's between a Christian and an atheist. And the Christian asked the atheist, "How do you define between right and wrong?" To which the atheist responded, "The same way that I define between yellow and blue." To which the Christian responded and asked, "And how is that?" And the atheist said, "By seeing, of course, how else?" To which the Christian asked, "And how do you define what you see?" To which the atheist responded, "By my feelings, how else?" Now the Christian didn't say this, but he should have. He should have said, in some cultures, they feel like loving and caring for their neighbors, and in some cultures, they feel like eating them. Do you have a preference? Really? If you're going to go by your feelings. You see, what one man may consider violence and a violation of that which is right, another man may consider justice. We must know God for us to know what is just and what is wrong. Eliminating God because we cannot reconcile what we see with the ultimate purpose of love and that life is sacred. If what we see persuades us that there is not an ultimate purpose of love and that life is sacred, and because of that we eliminate God, we are effectively removing any basis on how to determine what is good and what is right, what is evil, what is, and so forth. There's another aspect to violence, and it is the greater one, actually. Here at the beginning, I wanted to make a bit of a, get us thinking, make an intellectual argument, if you will. But violence, the greater reality of violence is that it assaults our emotions. You know, when I think back to what I saw when the Twin Towers came down, there was nothing intellectual about that. I did the intellectual stuff much later. And I, you know, as some of you know, I came to some conclusions that other people maybe didn't. But that's beside the point. I think anybody, for today it is anyways, I think anybody who watched that could not watch it without their emotions being affected. The greater reality of violence is not that you think it through and whether you want to believe in God or whether you don't. You don't really think about that. But violence affects the emotional part of who you are immediately. It can't be helped. When I watched that woman run away from the tower screaming with tears running down her cheeks, it just touched my emotions. When I think of children that I have never seen being abused and sexually exploited, and I don't know them, I don't intellectually think about this. Just it touches my emotions. It's my emotions that cry out violence, and then my head tries to catch up with what I'm feeling. Violence attacks the very fabric of humanity's emotional makeup, and that is why we cry, "How long, Lord, will you look at evil and do nothing? How long must I cry for help? Why do you look at this and do nothing about it?" Well, let's look at some of the things that I think Habakkuk understood when God was talking to him that brought him to the place where he expressed trust in God despite circumstances. Chapter 2, verse 20. The Lord is in his holy temple. Let all the earth keep silence before him. Before this, he's describing the idolatry of the world, in this case the Chaldeans. But they are dreaded and fearsome. Their injustice, their justice and dignity go forth from themselves. Do you see the difference? Their justice and dignity go forth from themselves. It is not God's justice nor a dignity that God recognizes. It is something that springs out from themselves, that goes forth, and it goes forth from themselves. Guilty men whose own might is their God. They don't have a God. It is their justice, their dignity, what they are, springs from within. There is not a God who dictates what is right and acceptable. It is what I feel, the same way I define between yellow and blue, you know? And so I think that God, in showing Habakkuk that about the men that he's complaining about, and then saying that but the Lord is in his holy temple, let all the earth keep silence. The Lord simply is. You know what God said to Abraham? I am. He didn't describe himself, he just said I am. And so in opposition to men making themselves gods, determining for themselves what is just and what is right and what is good, if they even care. but defining the difference to that is that there is a God, and that's what God is saying. The Lord is in his holy temple. Let all the earth keep silence before him. Verse 14 in chapter 2. For the earth will be filled with the knowledge of the glory of the Lord as the waters cover the sea. And he began his answer by saying, for the vision awaits its appointed time. It hastens to the end. It will not lie. If it seems slow, wait for it. It will surely come. It will not delay. The righteous shall live by faith. And so he is effectively telling Habakkuk, you cannot merely confine yourself to what you are seeing right in front of you in the here and now. The vision awaits an appointed time. If it seems to linger, if it seems to not be, wait for it. It will come. And part of that vision that awaits this appointed time, I believe, is explained in verse 14. For the earth will be filled with the knowledge of the glory of the Lord as the waters cover the sea. The Lord is in his holy temple. Let all the earth keep silence. Thinking about violence again, I think I'll share with you the what drove me to the book of Habakkuk this last time. I've looked at it different times, and I think it was a combination, perhaps, of becoming increasingly aware of the sexual abuse of young children within our own community, geographical community, and faith community, actually. Known as plain people and the community at large, perhaps I should verify that, faith community, not confined to our little church here, but faith community known as plain people. but it reached the pinnacle that Sunday morning when Tom texted from Kitchener that a young girl from Kitchener had overdosed and lay in critical condition on a hospital bed with doctors offering no hope of life. Something inside of me snapped, and I got up, and I went out to our vehicle, because I knew I needed to get it alone. And I didn't turn to Habakkuk, and I don't remember what I said, but it could have been something much like this. Why do you make me see iniquity? Why do you look idly at wrong? Destruction and violence are before me. Strife and contention arise, so the law is paralyzed. And justice never goes forth. See, it becomes personal when it's people you know. It becomes very personal when you know their circumstances. If a person you know well, and you know what he was struggling with, or he or she was struggling with, and they commit suicide, it is not just another number. You know the life they lived up to then. You know the pain they felt. And you know how they chose to deal with it. And it becomes very, very personal. And I knew this girl. I didn't know her well. But I knew enough about this girl that I knew that she had a lot of pain in her life. She'd made horrible choices, yes. Those choices came because of pain in her life. And she didn't know where to turn to. And a lot of the circumstances that she found herself in were not her fault. She had no say in the matter. She had no say in the matter of being born to a mom who was a drug user and a heavy drug user. She had no say in the matter of her mom jumping from man to man. She had nothing to do with that. And we're kidding ourselves if we believe that those circumstances do not affect how a person lives and acts. And so it becomes personal. And it seemed to me that morning that she never really had a chance to choose anything good, that her circumstances all schemed against her. And I grappled with it. And I felt a kinship with Habakkuk. And I turned to Habakkuk since that. Well, I don't know that I can effectively answer those difficulties. I know that God when God created humanity, he created them in the image of God. He created them, and he said that it was good. And I think that we need to understand that life is precious, life is sacred, and that there is an ultimate purpose of love. At the same time, I think that we cannot ignore and just pretend that we don't see what we do. I can't. I can't live with that. I can't pretend that we don't see violence. I can't pretend that we don't see atrocious abuses of the sacredness of life. I realized that an idol is anything that we turn to other than God to meet our emotional needs. Rather than trusting in our own creation to meet our needs, we need to bow to the Lord and let him meet them. And that's effectively what God was telling Habakkuk at the start here. The Lord is in his holy temple. Let all the earth keep silence. And if the vision awaits its appointed time, it hastens to the end, it will not lie. If it seems slow, wait for it. It will surely come. It will not delay. If we have a problem understanding that or reconciling what we see with an ultimate purpose of life being sacred and God caring and there being an ultimate purpose of life, that life is precious and an ultimate purpose of love, then we need to listen to what God told Habakkuk. The vision awaits its appointed time. It hastens to the end. It will not lie. If it seems slow, wait for it. It will surely come. It will come. Ultimately, the answer to the questions such as these is the cross. Every time. The cross redefines the reality of evil and shows God right in the middle of our need. You see, when we come before God and we scream violence and why aren't you doing something about it, very quickly we tend to not see him as being a part of our pain, but as being out there with the power to do something about it. And not maybe feeling what we feel because he's not doing anything, which is not true anyways, but that's how we feel. So the cross redefines the reality of evil and shows God right in the middle of our need. The other thing we do when we look out there and we see evil and violence is we tend to look away. And I would like to, if we could, bring the reality of evil a little closer to home. And that's why I say the cross redefines the reality of evil and shows God right in the middle of our need. Evil exists in a human heart. The ability to violate exists in a human heart, every human heart. For some people, we see it more, and we tend to focus on that, Adolf Hitler, for example. But that line between good and evil runs right through our own being. And that's where the cross redefines it. Suddenly, we begin to see that not only is evil out there, and we strive, and we fight against it, but evil is not something that is out there and comes in. It is something that is within, and that's how it needs to be dealt with. I'll read another little clip from V.A. Vassell. He was a prisoner in Auschwitz, and he survived it. And he tells the story of how when he was... Elie Wiesel tells the story of how, when he was in the German concentration camp of Auschwitz, he was forced, along with many of the other prisoners, to watch the public execution of three Jewish men. The first two men were older men, and they died quickly without much of a struggle. The third man was a young man, and he struggled and fought. He hung there from the gallows, and they were forced to watch it. And as Wiesel was standing there, he heard a man behind him mutter, "Where are you, God?" And instantly that same question rose in his own heart, "Where are you, God?" And he says, just as quickly as the question rose in his mind, God answered him. And he said, "I'm right out there on the gallows with him. Where else would I be?" So he's asking, "Where are you, God?" And instantly the same question rose in his own heart, "Where are you? Where are you in all of this, God?" And Wiesel says that just as quickly the answer came to him, hanging right there with him, "Where else?" You see, whether you believe that literally or not, I don't. But what God was telling Wiesel was that in the middle of evil and suffering and violations and violence, I am not removed from you watching it without feeling anything. I am right there, and I am feeling what you feel, and I am understanding what you feel, and I feel everything that you do, and the cross proves it. The cross redefines the reality of evil and shows God right in the middle of our need. And I think when we come to those conclusions, when we understand that and we allow it to soak in, we can say with Habakkuk in verse 17 of chapter 3, "Though the fig tree should not blossom, though my circumstances should be anything but favorable, nor fruit be on the vines, the produce of the olive fail, and the fields yield no food, the flock be cut off from the fold, and there be no herd in the stalls, yet will I rejoice in the Lord. I will take joy in the God of my salvation. God, the Lord, is my strength. He makes my feet like the deer's feet. He makes me to tread on high places. He brings me to high places where I am not stuck in seeing things merely from my perspective down here, where everything seems wrong. And he brings me up to where I can see it from his perspective," which in a way feels somewhat like I'm simply making words, because I'm not up there all the time. I wouldn't scream violence, and I wouldn't cry and beg for justice if I was totally persuaded that this was all within God's will, which I'm not. But what it is saying is that despite these things, the ultimate purpose of God stands, and though the vision awaits an appointed time, though this reality of the earth being filled with the knowledge and the glory of the Lord as waters cover the sea, it awaits an appointed time, and it's coming, and it's sure, and we can rest in that. And on top of that, in our struggle against evil and violence, not only in our own hearts, not only what we see rising up in our own hearts, and I'm sure we do. If you don't, I'm sure you do. There's times when you see without a doubt that line that runs in your own heart between good and evil is constantly there. Evil doesn't come from without, it comes from within. What have you done about it? The cross is the only way to deal with that. And if we see violence, we know that the cross has not taken hold of the people committing the violence. So those, I don't know if some of those thoughts, it is what I had to share. I struggled with the idea of sharing things that seem negative. Church is a place to come to rejoice and be encouraged and bless the Lord and so forth. And I like coming to church there then. However, that the issue of violence and struggling to come to grips with it is very real. We can't ignore it. I can't ignore it. We can't ignore it. It just is. And the answer to it, I cannot say enough, is the cross. God hanging there right with him, right in the middle of our pain. He feels everything that we do. And the cross proves it.